The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
So we return to looking into this dialogue between layman Pang and the Zen monk who questioned him. And this is from a different translation. It's by Andy Ferguson, who collected a number of his translations in a book called Zen's Chinese Heritage. So just, I find that sometimes slightly different translations or extremely different ones can reveal things to me that I wasn't aware of before. So here is Andy Ferguson's translation. Layman Pang was leaving Yao Shan. So Yao Shan had 10 Zen guests accompany Pang to the main gate. The layman pointed to the falling snow and said, "Good snowflakes, each one not falling any other place." At that time, a Zen monk named Chuan asked, "Where do they fall?" The layman struck him. Chuan said, "Even a layman should not act so rudely." Pang Yan said, "A so-called Zen guest saying such a thing. Yama, the king of hell, will never release you." Chuan said, "What do you mean?" Pang Yan hit him again, saying, "You have eyes like a blind man, and your mouth speaks like a mute." Later, Shui Do said, "When he asked the first question, I would have made a snowball and hit him with it." So this is a story that comes down to us from a few different sources. There's a record of Layman Pang's travels and encounters with people that contains many stories about him. And I did a little research following the talk yesterday, just so I could ground myself in his life story. Because one of the things that is important to me in working with koans is to know a little bit of background, but also to be able to imagine who these people were, even though they're nothing like me on many category levels. They're like me in the sense that they're human beings who have undertaken the great way. And so in that sense, they're like all of us. I remember hearing a Tibetan teacher once talk about how all of us belong to the same two nose hole society. This is our common human beingness. And so all these people have, just like us, the same kinds of questions and struggles and joys and sorrows. Just like us, they have to get out of bed in the morning, go to the bathroom, get dressed, and then go off and do whatever it is they need to do. In the case of being at a sesshin, that means going to sit. And for all of us who are engaged with Boundless Way Temple, that could mean going to sit in the temple or going to sit in your own home every day or every day and a few nights a week, every sesshin that arrives that is possible for you to do. When we come to sesshin, things get a little simpler. But one of the great things about Pang, or Pang Yun was his full name, is that he continued to live with his wife and children. But it turns out there were times he left them behind. He went to monasteries to study, and we were wondering yesterday, we didn't have all the information about how that worked out for him. What was his life like? Was he visiting a number of monasteries and then going home to his family? And it appears, and of course, this isn't really history, this is a kind of mythological history. This stuff happened so long ago. If you think about it, at this time in Europe, where many of our ancestors are from, the 9th century and the very beginning of the 9th century and mostly the 8th century, things that were going on in Europe were pretty unformed. If we wouldn't be able to talk to somebody who lived back then. All of the writings from those times are from a different language. Even if our heritage is English, we wouldn't understand what they were saying or writing. We have to interpret things through the lens of our own modern hearts and minds. And so the same here. These were people who lived in 9th century China, who, it turns out, had a wonderful connection with each other. Han Yun was one of a bunch of friends who were, some of them, quite wild Zen teachers, wild and wacky. They're renowned for being unconventional. And when he was still a student, he did go and stay with one teacher, his first teacher, who was Shito. And as Michael reminded us yesterday, Shito has written some of our wonderful texts in our sutra book. And Shito recognized his awakening. I couldn't find any sources that said that he gave him Dharma transmission, but he definitely was acknowledged by the great teacher Shito. But then he went on to study with Matsu, and I think that's where he made a lot of these friends. So many people studied with Matsu, great Master Ma, and he was one of them, and also Zen Master Ma gave him acknowledgement and perhaps transmission. But it's this last little story that we have about him. Well, not the last of all the stories about Lam and Peng, but the story that we're looking into, where he is leaving Yaoshan's place. And Yaoshan was one of the students of Matsu, one of the Dharma heirs of Matsu. And I found one source where it says that Peng Yun stayed with him for 17 years. I don't know what his wife and his kids were doing. I think his kids were grown up by then. But he actually stayed in the monastery with his friend Yaoshan for 17 years. So he was in residence there. He never ordained, but he was definitely an important person in the monastery, someone who had studied with two other great masters, just like Yaoshan had studied with Matsu. So a great respected person when this story begins. And he was so respected that Yaoshan, in bidding him farewell, sent 10 other so-called Zen guests. These were Zen practitioners, Zen priests who had wandered into Yaoshan's monastery and stayed there for a little while. And they came and went. There was a big tradition at this time in China for people to go from monastery to monastery. And so these particular 10 people had been staying with Yaoshan and Peng Yun at this monastery. So he decided to leave, and you know, he went off back to his family, also went on a bunch of other places. He went to a bunch of other places to really test himself again and again and again. He was a person, apparently, if you believe what you can read about him, who never gave up on this great path. He knew that there was not a place we could get to where we can say, oh yeah, I got it, thanks. Now I think I'll study the I Ching, or I'll study music, or maybe I'll go back to school. He knew that there was no end to Zen practice, just like we know that now. Anyone who's been involved for even a little bit may suspect that this is not something you get and then you carry around with you. It is instead, in my opinion, a way of understanding life through a different viewpoint than the one that we've been grasping onto for all of our lives. When we begin to see the truth, then the world reveals itself to us. And when we speak, the words of the Dharma come out of our mouths. When I now give Dharma talks, I heartily chanted the Gatan opening the sutra because I was feeling, I don't know what this Dharma talk is going to come out. I didn't sit and spend hours writing anything out. Some Zen teachers do that. So that's just a way that people can offer these Dharma talks. But for myself at this point in my Zen studies, I am kind of intrigued, excited. What is going to happen? And what I like to do is look into maybe one thing in a koan especially, or a text that points to the great heart of the matter and that I can relate to personally. When I investigate a koan and I ask my students to do the same thing, I encourage people to become the people in the koan, to figure out who the cast of characters are. And and I like to start with the most deluded one, because that's the person I mostly identify with. The one who maybe asks all the wrong questions or doesn't understand what's going on or gets fooled or whatever. What was the inner life of that person like? Is anything like my inner life? So in this koan, there are 13 named characters, which I think is really interesting. There's those 10 Zen guests. Well, I guess 12, because this guy who asks all the questions, Chuan, he's one of those 10 Zen guests. And then, of course, there's Peng Yun himself, who is the great revered layman and the guest, not just an overnight guest, but the guest of his buddy Yaoshan in the monastery, 17 years of companionship, of intimacy. It's a long time. Some of you in this room, I've known for even longer than that. The learning, as I think you might agree, never ends. And the intimacy never ends. I'm not talking about ordinary intimacy. I'm talking about a way of encountering another person where the masks that we put on in order to protect ourselves from harm can be set aside, and two human beings can be together in the middle of all of this challenging world that, as Shakyamuni Buddha, the founder of Buddhism, said, is full of dissatisfactoriness. Things are never the way we want them to be. So we put our masks on to protect ourselves from the slings and arrows, as another great writer called them. The way that we're so tender and vulnerable to all of the difficulties that keep arising no matter what. And of course, the joys keep arising too, but because we're mammals, our brains and our whole system is geared towards self-protection. It's self-protection that we get better and better at, and that's where those masks come in. Pretending the soft, vulnerable heart, mind, body of us human beings, that if we feel, if it was revealed and demonstrated to someone, we might get hurt. We might get damaged somehow by being seen. One of the great compliments in Zen practice and in some of these koans is when a Zen teacher praises someone else by saying, fully revealed, fully revealed. So it's a little bit like this. The tenderness is so apparent that there's no way that you could dismiss it. And the one who has revealed themselves, revealed their hearts, also cannot be damaged in that revelation. In a way, this is where we're heading as Zen practitioners, to a place where the ego doesn't get so wrapped up. We talked a lot yesterday about being criticized or redirected in our practice, and how that can be so hurtful. Because, of course, the mind, part of ourselves comes up and says, no, 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 you don't understand. You don't understand. I really meant well. And of course, that's a given. Every single person means well. Not, there are really no exceptions to that. And we could get into a whole argument about people who seem very, very destructive and awful. You know, probably names are popping up in your mind right now, just based on history and even current events. But what if all of us had that tender, vulnerable heart? And what if some people's masks are thicker than others? What if that were true? What if everyone you encounter is trying as hard as they can to survive? I think that might be true. So, of course, the character that attracted me here was Chuan, the Zen monk. And I also love this translation. Ping points to the falling snow and he says, good snowflakes. He doesn't say beautiful snowflakes. It's like he's praising the snowflakes for doing the right thing. Actually, let me stay with that for a little bit. There's something that sometimes happens to us, and we really can feel it most strongly in Sesshin when we can't any longer keep in mind all the effing forms. I pulled myself back. But they can be so overwhelming. Do I turn left? Do I turn right? Do I lift my bowl now or some other time? Do I bow here? When do I do this? When do I do that? What's going on? What's going on? And I hope everyone has noticed that all of the people running this particular session have made all kinds of, in quotes, mistakes. Lots of funny moments, really, if you appreciate that it's impossible to follow the forms. A couple of times when Michael and I have looked at each other and gone, what do we do? And some of them have been more public, like, when do we put on our wamsus and all this kind of stuff. And many of you who are in leadership positions, I think you know, because the ego eye does tend to hold on to those things, grasp them really tightly, and think that they mean something about who we are, which is probably the biggest joke that human beings carry around. My mistakes define me. Whoa, that's an interesting delusion. How about nothing defines you? How about maybe you are just present as best you can, moment after moment? When I think that way about myself, and I don't always, I get a sense of release and freedom. And I've had that happen to me a few times during this session. Last night before dinner, I mentioned this to a couple of you, I was just so happy. Sometimes that does happen at Sesshin. It hasn't happened for you. Yes, it may. Takes different forms. But I was just feeling like, wow, everything's going along so well. I don't have to work that hard. People are doing everything. My phone was running out of juice and Michael found a charger for me. You know, things like that. The soup was cooking in the kitchen, and you know, just it was perfect. And then, of course, just an hour or so later, we lost the contact with some of you. Our screen went out, and then the police showed up because a neighbor had called them because they heard an alarm going off at the temple. And what they actually heard was the ringing of our bells. Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. I guess it could sound like that. It was very worrisome. There was something wrong with the TV screen here. There was something wrong with the doorbell. I love that Paul was giving the talk last night, just wonderful talk. And he just kept going. You know, Jenny Estanto, she got up. Michael, as the resident, he got up. And they went and talked to the police and reassured them. But I was really interested personally in how my serenity just totally disappeared. I started telling stories, but well, last session ever, I guess we'll have to put the building on the market and find another place. Just, you know, I mean, maybe you do that too. It was so vivid. The vividness of the pleasure before dinner was equal in intensity for me to the vividness of the, uh-oh, everything's falling apart. It's so easy to go back and forth and back and forth. We make life into categories. we say good and bad. So here's Hengyun saying, good snowflakes, you're doing it right. He's saying, this is a different way of looking at this line. Each one not falling any other place. What a beautiful statement. Very different from saying beautiful snowflakes, praising the snowflakes for their beauty. Instead, praising them for doing the right thing. Every snowflake is, we cannot criticize these snowflakes. I guess that's what it is. There's no corrections. There's no, you might want to just lower your shoulders a little bit when you bow. You might want to, you can imagine what we could say to people and to snowflakes. I don't think so. Snowflakes are beyond correction, unless, we're sitting in our house and there's a big storm and we're thinking, how am I going to shovel all this? But even that, they're falling exactly correctly. Good snowflakes, they don't fall anywhere else. But then Chuan, and this is the person I just want to dig a little bit into, he says, and I can imagine him coming from a lot of different perspectives. He says, where do they fall? And, partly you could say, you idiot, look, they're falling right at your feet. Can't you see them? They're falling all around you. Like Michael going on his run in the woods. There's not even falling. There's just snow everywhere. Snow is often used in Zen as a metaphor for thusness, for emptiness, just everything is it. And we read a reference to it in The Harmony of Relative and Absolute earlier, where the author referred to, Dongshan actually referred to snow in a silver bowl, which is a reference to one of our Indian ancestors who when he demonstrated his understanding to his teacher, he took a needle and put it in a bowl of water. So you couldn't see the needle anymore. This is how thusness manifests itself sometimes as you can't see it. Everything, there's another koan we do called 1,000 mountains are covered with snow. 1,000 mountains, that's the first line of it. 1,000 mountains are covered with snow. And this is pointing to the same teaching of the needle in the water, the snow in a silver bowl. You can't see where the bowl ends and where the snow begins. 1,000 mountains are covered with snow. Everything is demonstrating the great way. Equally, even though every part of reality also differentiates into Melissa and Michael and Bill and Will and all of you, all of us, there's differentiation. There's individuality. There's only your experience, as one of my favorite teachings from Uchiyama Roshi is, no one can fart for another. Take that on, it's very deep. Mm-hmm. This is the way it is being human. We are completely individual. All forms are completely unique to themselves. Microphones pick up sound and cushions support us. And the floor glistens in the sunlight, and all of these things are unique to themselves. And at the same time, 1,000 mountains are covered with snow. At the same time, everything is only itself. I love the phrase, just this, which refers to both sides of this understanding of form and emptiness, as we say in the Heart Sutra. Form is no other than emptiness, and emptiness is no other than form. Everything is covered with snow. Nothing can be distinguished. And then, of course, right away, it can be. So this question from this Zen monk, one of the visitors to the monastery, I feel when I really get inside it, comes from a place of profound innocence. He wants to understand what the teacher's saying, but he doesn't quite get it. What does it mean they don't fall any other place? And he could also mean, is there some other place they could be falling? Isn't the world as it is just the way it is? with all of the things that happen? Aren't earthquakes earthquakes and wars wars and shootings? Isn't the rice delicious? Isn't the oatmeal delicious? Isn't that just the way it is? Maybe that's where he's coming from. How could you say they don't fall somewhere else? So he's checking. He's saying, so explain this to me. Where are they falling? And the answer is, and we talked about this yesterday quite a bit in our Dharma dialogue, right here. This is one of the most profound and simple and straightforward of Zen teachings. Everything is right here. You don't need to go anywhere else. Everything is completely present. One of you quoted Linji to me, another one of these teachers who was around in this period. And he said, why do you go to your neighbor's house? That's how I remember it anyway. Stay here, just this. There's no other place. Why are you fooling yourself? Everything you've ever wanted, already present. That doesn't make any sense at all because, you know, I want this and I want that and especially at Sashin, I want the bell to ring. What is going on over there? I want there to be different food on the snack table. I want this, that, or the other thing. I want my bed to be different. I don't want to be sleeping in a room with someone who snores. I don't know. I just should stop. But you can fill in all the blanks here. I want. I've said this before. The very first Sathin I ever attended, watching my mind, it only produced sentences that began with, I want. I was so blown away by this. I remember going into my Zen teacher and saying this. And all he said, he just shrugged. It's not a big deal to him. It was sort of like, duh, where do the snowflakes fall? Well, right here. This is how it is. It's not some other way. So then the layman strikes him, hits him. That hit is like the hits we get in our lives. It's like falling and hitting your head or being in a car accident. David and I know a little bit about those things. You all know things. Things get snatched away. People die unexpectedly. Relationships break up. You get a diagnosis of some sickness. So many hits that life is offering us. And if indeed those hits are intended to wake us up, I don't believe that there's some figure in the sky looking down and hitting us. But they do have the function, if we recognize them for what they are, disruptions. Disruptions to the narrative of our life, the way we think things are supposed to be. It's a strong narrative, and it's painful. Things are not the way we want them to be. Every once in a while, they coincide, which is great. We get a new car or whatever. The package from Amazon is delivered on time, and you open it up, and it's actually what you wanted. I was just thinking about a book delivery I got from Amazon. I was really looking forward to getting this book, and it was a pornographic novel. I didn't order it. It's not what I ordered. And we might say that, this is not what I ordered. I don't want it. Go away. Where do they fall? And he hits him. It's not a love pat. It's like, wake up, you idiot. Stop doing this to yourself. How could things be any different than this? Why are you asking this question? And it's really all condensed into, cut it out. In the first koan that we work with in our tradition, when somebody asks a question like this, the teacher says no, even though the answer is supposed to be yes. Very similar to the skit. Very similar to what Layman Pang is trying to do. And Chuan insults him, I love to see the ego rise up. Even in the 9th century, people apparently had a lot of self-esteem issues. And he says, you're a layman, even you the lowest of the low, shouldn't act like this. What a sad thing for him to say. It's like he throws his mask right back on. He exhibited a moment of tenderness. He was really curious. He got hit, and instead of letting it wake him up, he insulted the teacher. That happens, by the way, quite a bit. I used to think that that was not part of my narrative, and I've learned better. And then Peng insults him back. In a way, it's like a little game of table tennis. Well, okay, we're playing a different game now. It's not just you ask me a question and I give you an answer, which is the hit. But now you insult me, and I'll insult you back. He says, even one of these Zen guests, how could you say such a thing? The king of hell will never release you. And for me, that's a wonderful metaphor too, because that's how my self-narratives feel. They feel like the king of hell squeezing me, and I can't escape. I want to be released from these stories of being no good and not knowing enough. And the world is this way, the world is that way. When those stories start to ease, and we can't do it, but when the king of hell eases his grip, something shifts, something happens. And then Chuan comes back. I think that's the thing that maybe gets him. He says, what do you mean? We have to be admiring of a person like this, who just, he asks a question, he gets hit back, he gets defensive, teacher gets defensive, and then he comes back. What do you mean? For me, the whole koan rotates around, what do you mean? What do you mean? What's going on here? I want to know. And then Peng insults him again. And that's where Xuedo's comment is so wonderful. And I'll end that. Xuedo is the guy who put all these koans together in the Blue Cliff Record, comments on them. He says, when he asked the first question, I would have made a snowball and hit him with it. And I think that's the secret, the thing that's immediately here. If someone is fully present, then the world offers itself to us and we can play with it. We can scoop up the snow and make a ball and laugh and throw it. Imagine a life like that. We've all tasted it. Now we have the opportunity to have a full meal of it. Layman Peng was leaving Yao Shan, so Yao Shan had 10 Zen guests accompany Peng to the main gate. The layman pointed to the falling snow and said, good snowflakes, each one not falling any other place. At the time, a Zen monk named Chuan asked, where do they fall? The layman struck him. Chuan said, even a layman should not act so rudely. Pang Yun said, a so-called Zen guest saying such a thing. The king of hell will never release you. Chuan said, what do you mean? Pang Yun hit him again, saying, you have eyes like a blind man and your mouth speaks like a mute. Later, Xuedo said, when he asked the first question, I would have made a snowball and hit him with it. Thank you. So please be at ease, and in the Zendo, come around to make our new shape. And David Roshi and Michael and I will answer questions, trade insults, whatever is required. No snowball, it hasn't snowed. We're having a snow drought, so there you go. But let's start with Motu.
Thank you so much for the wonderful talk, Melissa Rossi. I really loved it and I even cried. I'm really touched by this, the correct character of this young monk and, his questioning spirit. And the question that comes to me is, and this is something that is very personal to me too, so I want to ask it. So why can't we all stay as innocent as this young monk and, ask question and wonder? why do we have to be transmitted teachers? Why do we have to wear robes? And why do we have to, you know, be, you know, layman Pang or anybody? You know, why can't we just be like this young monk forever?
Are you sure you're not like that young monk, Modu?
I am 100% like that right now. And all I'm saying is I'd like to stay like that forever and not be categorized or put into boxes.
Yeah. The thing about boxes is that they are wonderful. They are life itself. We might dream that we, instead of sitting on the cushion, we could be suspended in a saline sack where we wouldn't feel discomfort and our neck and knees wouldn't hurt. And oh, wouldn't that be much nicer? Actually, no, this world, of course, the boxes, if we believe them, can be so painful because they're not true. But yet, you know, the sound of the bell, everything that arises is manifesting, is not separate from this world you're speaking of.
And I just want to add.
And now I want to add that this innocent monk, Chuan, he didn't stay that way even for the length of the story. You know, he was innocent and then he became abusive. That he said these mean things, and then he went back to the innocence. So in a way, another way of looking at this is that it's cyclical, right? I felt this myself, that, you know, I started out pretty innocent. I didn't know what the heck Zen was or anything. David and I, the first time we heard a Zen teacher, we walked out because it didn't make any sense. It just was nonsense, felt nonsense. But then we go into a place where we think, oh, I get it. And that starts to adhere to us, sticks to us, and then it falls away again. And so this is the possibility that innocence never really disappears, but sometimes it recedes a little bit. Yeah.
And I also find it interesting that you said this monk was a young monk, because there's no mention of the age or anything. But what I feel is, you know, that's maybe young as opposed to sort of in our linear thinking that we say, well, the inexperienced to the experience. But what Melissa just said about this circular thing, this is more how reality flows, not in a linear way, more circular. So this monk could have been an older monk, but suddenly opportunity every moment to awaken.
Anybody in the Zendo?
Yeah, thank you for the talk, Melissa. There's a lot there. But I just keep getting the image of the snow in the face, like the Shuedo. Is that?
Yeah,
Shuedo's comment. I just hit him in the face with a snowball. I don't know if it says in his face, but I mean, it's just unexpected and unpleasant and waking me up.
Exactly, right? Yeah, the waking up.
And
the waking up is so important. My mic was off, sorry. Well, David, why don't you say what you were going to say, and then I have some more.
I was just going to say that, appreciating, Melissa, what you'd said about the playful nature of this, you know, both the shock, but also not imparting some great Zen teaching and not entering through, well, let's really figure this out. Let's parse it. But just that.
Yeah, the police was kind of like that.
Well, exactly. Yeah, that when the doorbell rang, we all heard the doorbell, right on line two. I think you were still with us. We had some technical difficulties too. It was kind of wild. But right, the interruption. It's an interruption. When I was young, there was a time when I was studying with my first teacher. I can't remember what was going on with my koan practice at the time, but it was snowing very heavily at the little monastery where we had our retreat. And I was going out to maybe do some shoveling, and he was coming in from shoveling. And we met in the little entryway where I was putting on my boots. And we were very strict in that Zen group about no eye contact whatsoever. He grabbed me and looked right at me, and he said, "What is it?" Wild and wacky, right? And so I grabbed some snow and I threw it at him, and he bowed and went on. Right? So there is that playfulness, and it's serious too. That's what I wanted to say as well. But I did not plan that in advance. I was pretty shocked that he would make eye contact and grab me like that. He had a lot of boundary issues. But it also, I'll never forget it, that moment. Who scooped it up? I didn't plan it in advance. Yeah.
Thanks.
Chad.
Thank you for the talk. There's a lot of things, as Jenny was saying in this, but what arose for me was really this sort of continuum of life all in one spot, right? There's anger, there's innocence, there's questioning, there's knowledge, there's lack of knowledge. And it's all like, even just like this sesshin to me, it's like, I'm exactly where I need to be, just like the snowflake falling.
Just to comment, just like a snowflake falling, this is sort of the effect that sometimes being in snow has. You pinpoint each individual snow and then snowflake, and you can see it for a moment, and then it disappears among all this other snow that kind of just envelops the space that you're in. And then you can point something out, and then you can pull back. It's just that incredible pulling and back and pushing in.
And then, Chad, appreciating you talking about, so everything is here, and we might think, oh, that's really sweet and calm. Well, sometimes it might be, but this everything, this life has room for everything. So we're not trying to become more calm. We're not trying to get rid of the troublesome parts of our personality or our narrative or our mind, but rather creating this bigger field to see it's all this arising and passing away, more and more room for things and for ourselves to be as we are.
Yeah.
Hi.
Oh, I'm sorry, Vinny. I just called on Vix, so I'll call on you in a moment.
Okay, I can't hear what you're saying, so.
Oh, so sorry about that, but we'll get to you. You're next.
Thank you for the talk. So as you were talking about dissatisfaction and as my knees were absolutely killing me, I've always found fascinating the nature of dissatisfaction, and especially during sesshin, the sort of like always moving cyclical nature of it, where it's like, wow, my knees are killing me. Okay, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Oh, wow, I just stopped suffering for a sec. Oh, wait, I want that to come back. You know, I want that to come back. Oh, wow, my knees are killing me again, and it just keeps going.
Yeah, beautifully observed. Thank you. Let's move to Betty now. It's you, Betty. Yep.
Yeah. Hi. Thank you for your talk. I thought that I heard you say something earlier, but I didn't quite grasp what it was, so I didn't know. I think when people are talking, they really need to use the microphone, or it doesn't come through clearly. So that's why I jumped on, because I thought you were calling me. I did enjoy the talk. I especially enjoyed getting the different rendition of the koan. yesterday I had when I heard that, I was confused, probably as confused as the monk, because the first thing I thought of was, well, where does the snow not fall? And I'm thinking, Africa, hell. you know, it was like I was thinking hot and cold and snow would melt there so it wouldn't fall. But this was a little different for me, and I like that. The other thing I want to say is that these discussions and even the readings today are bringing up a lot for me. And at moments I'm feeling like, oh yeah, that's really it. You know, this is really why I'm here. And then we went on to the Bodhisattva vow and that part where he says, you know, if somebody's treating you meanly, you should just bow down. And I'm like, no way, no way. I'm learning something different now. So anyway, that's just where I'm at right now. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That's great. Got it on. That's great, Betty. I chose that partly because I had this idea in my head that I was going to talk about that, that I think it really is very connected to what's going on between Peng and Chuan, you know, that weird dialogue they have where that, but it turned out to be irrelevant, but now it's relevant, right? Because you're bringing it in. These teachings are hard to understand because they flip-flop, you know, and I think a life in Zen, and you know this really well, there's openings and insights, and then there's the closings and the no, 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 that doesn't make sense. And then it opens again, and then it closes. And I think that's right. That's the snowflakes falling in the right place. It's a journey that is cyclical, like we've been saying, circular. Yeah. So thanks for naming that. Thanks for bringing our buddy in, Tori Zenji. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Just quickly, I wanted to say, I really appreciate you saying that line about what it's best to bow down, because that one was so hard for me to grapple with when I first heard it for a long time. Then I asked myself the question, okay, who am I bowing down to? And that right there opened up something.
And also, Betty, I'm caught by what you said too about one, appreciating that there's some teachings in the readings or in the, you know, when people say things that really resonate with us and we nod our head and we understand and agree with. And then there's some teachings that are like a snowball in the face. And it's not that we should believe it, because that's not what we're doing, but notice that. And then we could wonder, what might that mean? And I love, Michael, you saying that. So we might think, oh, it's bowing down. Thank you for being a jerk to me. Maybe it's not that. Maybe there's something else. And so both being with the teachings that resonate and that we can hold with us and that inspire us, and also hanging around with the teachings that are like, what? I know that's not true. This could not be it.
Thank you, Melissa. I guess, and Michael, that brought up also, who is it that's doing the bowing down? And that's the part that sort of puts me in a bind all the time when I feel like I'm being disrespected or whatever. I mean, only when I become part of the whole sort of game of being disrespected does it really affect me. So I just wanted to sort of ask a question. What do you think?
Thought Michael was going to answer that. Well, yes. You know, this is the question always. I mean, this was not one of my favorite koans, but as I had to look into it, this is what happens for me with koans. Now it is when I'm so glad that we decided to do it. Because of that back and forth, especially overnight when I was really dreaming, I actually had dreams about this koan, you know, which happens, right? Mostly that conflict between those two people. And who is, if it's a play of egos, then it's easier to understand what's going on, I think. You know, and with my life, which I almost never realize, if I can pull back just a little from the human interaction and go, oh, wow, I'm playing the role of the person who said something that hurt somebody, or I'm playing the role of the person who's been hurt by somebody else. And it really hurts. You know, it's not a joke, but it's also, it could switch on a dime. And I think that's what happens in this koan. It really switches. They both have at it. And you know, when a person is named in a koan, that's an indication that they were actually somebody important. Mm-hmm. So we don't know what happens to Chuan later. I don't see anything. Maybe we'll research some more, but so he was a person of substance, and you can kind of feel it, right? So you can feel also the tippy, a person of substance who doesn't exist. And, you know, he really gave it his all, but who was giving, who was bowing, who was talking? And I think that's a very root koan. Who is the one who is doing whatever this is? You know, who's the one who threw that snowball at my teacher years ago? It wasn't really me. Then I would have been all over. I would have gotten in my own way if it had been me. These things to say, and isn't there, there's neurological research that whenever we do anything, the brain comes in a millisecond later and says, and claims it. Yeah. So that's true with speaking, action, everything. And so in Zen, I feel like we're getting into, we don't need to bother anymore with who's doing what. It's just doing, being, doing. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa Roshi. Just really beautiful talk. You know, I was thinking of Layman Peng and why he's going from monastery to monastery, because I've been asking myself, why am I here? The question you asked us the first night. And then when you spoke about the mass coming off, you know, I went, oh, ding, ding, ding. Like, I'm here because we're taking off all our masks here. And then, you know, I immediately wanted so badly to have that intimacy with my family, with work, with different relationships. And then I found myself wanting a lot. And then I realized, and then I think you explained the police story and all this stuff. And I don't know if anyone else online, I didn't know any of this was going on. Like my experience, because of Corwin and Chad, has been like seamless. Like I didn't hear a bell. I didn't know there were technical difficulties. Like it's been amazing. And, you know, but I so appreciate everyone there talking about mistakes and you know, mix-ups and because, you know, it's like the masks are there, but it's a a facade either way. It doesn't matter if the masks are on, if they're off. Like it's just so beautiful to be together. And I so appreciate you saying, like, it's such a nice release to just acknowledge that this is what's happening. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate, Chumki, what you're saying about we can get into the thing like, okay, the thing is to take the masks off. And I'm just going to take it off and never put it on again. But that's another kind of mask, the mask of no mask. But this true freedom of possibility in the role of daughter, sister, parent, partner, friend, we can play the role in this larger context, in the dance of it. And in fact, in Zen, again and again, we're encouraged to be who we are and to enter the play of the moment. So part of the play in the Zendo is all of these crazy rules, right? Do this, turn that way. And we get to play with them, not because it's true and pure, and but because we put it on and then we learn. And then that is the point of practice, encountering all of this. Yeah, thank you.
Listen to my amazing talk. You know, the part in the beginning when you said, what's going to come out? And that's when I decided to say something. I thought, okay, I'm not going to be planning what I'm going to say and just see what comes out. And but the part about how you were so happy before dinner and then the police thing and everything. And yesterday walking after lunch, and the sun is out and it was like this la-di-da, lovely. And then there was a hawk like right there. And we were like communing, I guess. And the hawk just must have sensed that I was going to move, because it just like rose up. And it had the squirrel. I didn't know if it was a squirrel or bunny, but I guess it was a squirrel. It had a squirrel in its tail. It was so close. It was so close that I'm like, oh. And then so this fear came up, like, oh. But then there was this part of like, oh my gosh, there's this I really fell for the squirrel and this interconnectedness of beings. Like, usually the squirrels are eating or bird seed in our feeder, and I'm not like so fond of them, but it was then, you know, I don't know, just dangling there in the air. You know, it seemed like the head was gone. I don't know. It was just like, I didn't see the body.
Okay, I'm going to just stop you for a moment. Very good. One of the things that really interests me about this story is that I heard about that hawk and the squirrel from three different people yesterday, and every version of the story is different. So four and five. I just wanted people to raise their hands here in the Zendo. How many of you experienced the hawk and the squirrel? Yeah, a lot of people. Right. And if you didn't, no worries. You can make up your own story. But the thing that I love, you know, the Japanese movie Rashomon, which is about a murder that's seen by a whole bunch of different people, including then even they have somebody contact the ghost of the woman who was murdered, and she tells her story. All the stories are completely different. So one of the things that we do in Zen that I love, and I've always been interested, that I saw that movie when I was young, is how reality appears to be a certain way, and we learn from it. You had some wonderful insights, Deb, that grew out of it, and apparently a few other people did too. But we really never know what's going on, you know, and everything shifts and changes, and I appreciate that so much, that this of not, I guess, of being suspicious of every story. Yeah, maybe that's all I'll say. But yeah, that boy, I can see that hawk. I know exactly where he was in my mind. I have a story that I based on the three versions I heard. And now the other two of you, don't tell me the story. But it's just wonderful what human beings can do. And then when things start to drop away, we don't get rid of them. They loosen and they drop. It's kind of sweet. So let's have our last comment be from Jeannie on screen.
I've been hesitant to speak because sometimes I don't have words. But Melissa's saying she just talks. I figured I'll try it. I was really struck with our conversation about masks and taking it off, and Madhu's question about being in a box and wanting to stay innocent. And I just wanted to say that a lot of the best teachers I've seen are absolutely coming from that place of innocence. And we all know that when we hear a teacher speak. and that teacher has a sense of him or herself as a teacher, and there's that extra layer of I am a teacher, we know that our bullshit detector is going off. And when pure teaching is coming through, we know that and honor that. And I know for myself, having been in the role of teacher and not teacher, my fear of not doing it right, I should be a this, I should look like this, I should sound like this. And then sometimes teaching just comes through. So I don't know what to say about that except that. And also to know that for me, it's very hard to take the mask off. It's very hard to step out of the box because I was so trained as a young child that I did it wrong, that I was bad, I was breaking the rules. So I really am so grateful for the encouragement and the safety here to take off the mask and blow it, you know, and be the snow that's falling as I am. So thanks.
I appreciate you talking about these teachers. Have I told you about my new grandson? A Zen teacher, if there ever was.
Indeed. Yeah. So what a wonderful Dharma dialogue. And I think I just want to say one more thing. I'm inspired by Jeannie, but I don't know what it is that I want to say. But maybe I know what it was. It did occur and then fell away. It hurts to take the mask off. It's actually painful. It's not just, it shouldn't sound simple. It really is painful. As sometimes it rips and some skin comes away with it, right? So this is a process that we're not expecting everybody to take their masks off. But when they start to drop away, you can really get a sense of some new freedom. And I think the tradition in Zen, it's like the only word I can come up with is it's a technology for creating a sense of freedom that involves the mask dropping away. But it's slow and can be really painful. And sometimes it's really quick. And that's the other thing I was going to talk about, how there's so many different kinds of people in the harmony of relative and absolute. Sometimes it's sudden, sometimes it's gradual. Sometimes these people need jeweled things, and sometimes, you know, cats and white oxen. That it's a process for every one of us, and no one else can do the same thing. It's only you. You're the only one who can be the Zen student that you are. So saying that, let's come back into our posture for meditation.